always include my executives in a meeting, either in my office or their offices, to discuss the new requests from management on the car lines and trucks. They in turn would have their meetings with their managers in the studios. And they had several managers. Damon Woods had a manager for the light cars, like the Falcon, the Fairlane. And he had a manager for the Thunderbird area. And Damon Woods had another manager that was on the large cars. Mm-hmm. And in the truck area, Wagner would have a manager that was on the light trucks, and possibly another manager on the heavy trucks and tractors. And that was the general management lineup. I never bypassed my executives without formally letting them know that I was just coming to a studio, and I'd sit down, and on occasion I'd even sit with a designer at a table and talk about the designs as he was developing, just shooting the breeze. Mm-hmm. And if need be, I too would try, if I saw that the designer was way off the beam or not in the direction that we thought we should be going, I might even sit down at a table with a designer and do some sketching. And in addition to that, I requested that all my design execs do sketches. And I made them give contributions of their from their own hand on ideas for mm-hmm. the products. Mm-hmm. They in turn requested the same from their managers. In other words, I would not sit still for just edicting and managing without performance. Mm-hmm. In other words, I wanted my managers to be designers number one, mm-hmm. and to be able to design a car, and additionally have the ability to manage the people and manage, of course, working with the manufacturing people that would come in the studio, and the cost people and the feasibility people, product planners and engineers and so forth. We had a continuing Grand Central Station entourage going through every day of the week all year long. So our managers had to be able to deal with that, and also the execs, of course, and the managers. And then the managers had to make sure that they could delegate and inspire the young designers to make sure that they're properly grouped, so they don't go off and Timbuktu somehow, and they occasionally have to be brought back to reality. Mm-hmm. So I too would sit down at a drawing table and sketch, and occasionally, even for my execs, I would come into their office and I would say to them, you know, Damon, or you know, Bill Wagner, mm-hmm. I think that our truck should look like this in my judgment, or we should go in this direction. And I would give him a half a dozen or so sketches that I personally had done in my office. Mm-hmm. Because in my office, I had drawing facilities. And during other requirements of attending meetings and answering the telephones and so forth from other areas, I too would come up with ideas as to what I think it should be. Mm-hmm. Because I felt a sketch was worth more than words. You can use all kinds of adjectives in describing a design, but it becomes very difficult to pinpoint the adjectives in reality in three dimensions or on paper. So you finally have to get down to the crux of it and put down on paper what you are talking about. So many times I would go to my execs and say, Damon, I believe we ought to go in this direction, in this direction. And I'd have a skull session with them and say, now what do you think? And where are some of your ideas and so forth? And what would happen, some of my sketches would even get plastered up on a wall, was the rest of the designers. just as a benchmark for directional thinking, mm-hmm. to keep in mind.
Right.
And we did this. And then we would also bring all our designs on the cars and the trucks, not together, but individually to the showroom. And in the showroom, we critique. And all the designers would be there on the car line, and the managers and the execs, and I would be there. And we talk about our designs that we were proposing for the next car, all new, or all new Thunderbird, or a facelift Thunderbird, or a facelift for the cars, or a facelift for the interiors, or a facelift for the trucks, or an all-new truck,
mm-hmm.
and we'd talk about it. And we'd open it up, and I would make sure that everybody had a say. And I never permitted the youngest designer to get by without saying something in these meetings,
right.
whether he thought it was right or wrong. And if he thought it was wrong direction, that was perfectly all right. We wanted to know why he thought it was wrong. And after he said why, we also wanted to know, well, what are some of your recommendations? What would you have done? How would you have done it? This way we had a complete dialogue going constantly from the bottom up and from the top down. It was a give and take in both directions. And it was a very lively, competitive spirit in the Ford studio, and I'd say that it really worked.
It worked very well.
It worked very well.
Mm-hmm.
So all of the cars were developed generally in this way, including the trucks, and in complete detail. Now, eventually my responsibility to the interiors was divested from under my responsibility.
What happened there?
And what happened was that Lincoln Mercury and the Ford studio were hoarding materials. The suppliers would bring in the materials for the interior trim sets, and in their judgment they would give certain materials to the Lincoln Mercury, and in their judgment other materials to the Ford end. And generally, sometimes the Ford end got the wrong end of the deal because the dealers surmised that maybe they were too costly for the Ford end, or maybe this or that. And so a lot of the claws were being held in storage, and they were not being acted on. And so the full benefit wasn't there. In addition, the trim sets were getting extremely complicated for both Lincoln Mercury and Ford Division.
When you say trim sets, you mean?
Many trims, and many trim options,
okay.
and many
right.
colors,
yes.
and many fabrics, and many vinyls.
Right.
And it got to be cumbersome.
Mm-hmm.
And the color, exterior colors,
mm-hmm.
were the same. There were entirely different colors for the Lincoln Mercury cars and entirely different colors for the Ford cars. This proved to be very costly for Ford Motor because it was doubling up on painting, doubling up on trims, doubling up on a lot of things. So then it became evident out of sheer weight that it would be wiser to pool all of the interiors into one
department.
One department. So at that time, Bob McGuire was again given the responsibility from the advance. He was transferred to the interiors, and I was divested of the interior responsibility. And so was Gene Bordenay at the time, who was chief stylist of the Lincoln Mercury end.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Bob McNamara calling me one night late, and I was at the office doing some late hour letter reading, asking me what I really thought of this system. Was it a good idea that we do this? And I told Bob McNamara, in my judgment, it was the best thing for Ford Motor, because it would save Ford Motor an awful lot of duplication, and we could simplify our paint systems and save Ford money. And in addition to that, a lot of the fabrics that were being hoarded in the individual design interior offices of Lincoln, Mercury, and Ford could then get total visibility, because some of the fabrics I never saw, and Lincoln Mercury never saw some of the fabrics we had. So this wasn't right for the Ford products. So out of sheer weight, at that time, the interiors were centralized under Bob McGuire.
And that would appeal to Mr. McNamara.
And it appealed to Bob McNamara, because he was very cost conscious, and he was had a calculating mind, and he was quite regimented and
was a great one
organizer.
A great one for coalescing the effort.
Yes, the whole effort.
Yeah, right. That's interesting. Did any of this impinge on the development of the late 50s Fords? You mentioned a couple of incidents which exercised you at the time.
Yes, one of the later Fords. I will first mention the Ford, 57 Ford. The 57 Ford, 52 through 55 Fords, were good bread and butter cars, and they had their hard tops and verve, and they were a little bit in need of some new concept changes. The 57 was the Ford that gave us this new rebirth and rekindling. And the 57 Ford development, which I had inspired, and incidentally, the basic concept of this sheet metal, I had again started as, I was a consultant at the time, the 57 was being done, because this was done when we were consultants. And I remember Mr. Walker bringing in Bob McNamara to look at some of my thinking proposals for the 57 Ford in a special area I had up front in my office. And they walked in on me, and I had a chalk drawing of the 57 Ford car, and it had the wide double headlights, the very wide front fenders. And the dashing quarter panel fin. Now, the dashing quarter panel fin was also partly derivative from a specialty model that was being developed in the Ford studio area as a specialty show car.
Do you remember that particular model?
I can't recall its name now, but it had the fin on it in that verve, not exact detailing, but using that as a springboard, the back end, and the theme that I was proposing again for the new sheet metal, the front end concept, and the taillights, and the head and the greenhouse were all on this chalk drawing. And Bob McNamara was quite taken with it, and the next day George asked me to begin the model of this proposal that I had shown Bob McNamara the night before. I'd been working on as a consultant. Now, at that time, Frank Hershey was the chief stylist of the Ford studio, with Bob McGuire as his exec. And this is some of the tension I had reference to as consultants. Now, Frank Hershey, either rightly or enviously or however, he thought that was just too outlandish a design. It was just too wide a front fender to consider. Those double headlights in a wide squat thrusting front fenders with a slowly dropping hood between these two wide thrusting front fenders. And the model started developing, and in its original conception, I was trying to feel. As I mentioned, we had the ability to start cars as directed by Ford management. So I started the 57 model in the studio. Frank Hershey thought it was just too crazy. And he thought it should be stopped. It was gross. And in its original startup, I may have had the fenders just a wee bit too wide, but I was feeling it, you see, in its development. And I was feeling the front end relationship to the fenders and the quarters and the whole car as an integral piece. Frank was so distraught with the effort that he complained to Ford Division about it. And this he should never have done, because he called him up and said what an outlandish thing was going on in the Ford studio, and his recommendation would be to stop it. And this, of course, was what Bob McNamara had requested that we develop, but he didn't know it. And this proved to be a boomerang for Frank Hershey, because although the car started a little bit exaggerated in order to bring it in theme and bring it slowly into its home position, he shouldn't have called to stop the model. So it boomeranged in respect that the car kept developing and improving, and it finally was approved by management and the Ford management team as the 1957 proposal. And this car outsold its competitor that year, which was the 57 Chevrolet with the huge rear gull wings. And I believe, these came from the Chevrolet studio, and I heard of a name, but I just as soon not mention it, who was responsible for that Chevrolet. But Ford advertising had a field day with the 1957 Chevrolet in the advertisements that were run, and such as the garage door was open, and lo and behold, was that a car? Was it a bug, or what was that strange looking thing? And on the banter went. And of course the 57, I'm sorry, I've gotten that one out of line. The 59 Ford was the one that had the bantering process with the Chevrolet. But the 57 Ford proved highly successful, and it was number one that year in the industry in sales. It outsold Chevrolet that year. And it also, the 57 Ford was sent to Europe. Mr. Ford sent the 57 Ford to Russia, to the Russian Exposition in Moscow, to show what the typical American Ford working man's car was like in the United States. And of course the Russians didn't believe that the 57 Ford was really the working man's Ford car of the United States. They thought it was some fantastically luxurious car. Well, in the ensuing year, in 58, this was an area where I was completely overwhelmed with my problem as to what the 58 should look like. Product planning wanted to change the 57 Ford car radically as a facelift from stem to stern, from front to back. And they wanted a complete front end change, a dramatic front end change, and a dramatic back-end change, but again, to be as dramatically successful as the 57. This was quite a full basket to request.
This
proved to be an error.
In this context, excuse me for interrupting, product planning could do this.
Product planning had a very strong influence at this time.
Yeah.
And they did do that. Mm-hmm. They influenced the radical major changes on occasion, and they did boomerang. This one boomeranged in respect that the 58 Ford, although I was still responsible for it, I felt when it was finally approved that it was overworked, that we had tried too hard. Mm-hmm. It just was not as spontaneous a total theme as the 57. The 58 Ford front end borrowed now from the Thunderbird front end, but the proportion of the Ford car versus the Thunderbird proportion were radically different. The hood was so much higher than the Thunderbird hood from the ground, the cowl was, and the front end theme just didn't come off like a Thunderbird. But it was recognizable as a Thunderbird derivative. And the back end, again, we tried to pick up the theme from the Thunderbird with the dual lights in the wide pod of the Thunderbird at the time, and we incorporated that on the rear deck. But the detailing of the taillights on the rear deck of the 58 versus the detailing on the Thunderbird were entirely different. We detailed the Thunderbird sheet metal to accommodate that theme of the dual lights, deeply inset in this round cowling like a jet exhaust with the fin on the side, a gentle fin. Now, on the Ford car, of course, we didn't have that latitude, and we had other restrictions such as the deck lid requirements, the trunk requirements, and the trunk capacity, and we didn't have the depth of taillights and the dramatic quality of the Thunderbird to get some of that quality into the Ford car, nor could we get that quality strictly on cost, because the Ford car, cost-wise, as far as the taillight detailing in the back end, was not in the same league with the Thunderbird that was a luxury, sporty-type car. And so it proved to be a disaster. It was a theme, it sold, but I was never happy with it. And even today, I see them rarely, but I cringe every time I see this car. It was one car that I just was never happy with.
You've termed it a nightmare.
For me, it was a nightmare. It was a nightmare in respect that it was such a tremendous effort to change such a successful theme into something that was supposed to be radically different from the 67, and we didn't quite make it. And to me, that was a terrible agony.
Have you ever tried to analyze why product planning felt they should take a proven success and...
They didn't know it was going to be such a success, you see.
Yes, this was much before the fact.
Sure, before the fact.
Yeah.
And had they known, of course, the logic would have been, well, my gosh, just continue with the basics of the back end and the front end, modify it, adjust it, add some new detailing, some verve to it, and continue with the same theme. And we would have been much better off than doing such a radical about change that we did on the 58. So then on the 59 Ford, we had our chance again, because this was an all new car. And if I may take time out for, I have some of my reference material on hand now just to alert me so I don't forget a detail. The 59 Ford was all new sheet metal with a very wide front end hood fender appearance. And again, the hood sunken down between the wide fender, similar to the 57, but the back end had a rocket theme derivative, and again, aircraft influence.
A contemporary
and
influence.
So the rocket effect from the side, beginning with the rear door, and the rear door ending in the backup light.
Mm-hmm.
And underneath the backup light, we had these giant taillights, which must have been, probably about 9 inches in diameter, approximately.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very dramatic. And we treated the sheet metal, the bright work of the taillights with little serrations to give the effect of a jet turbine engine. So the car again was quite aircraft oriented, and this was the car that in that same year Chevrolet came out with its huge gull wing back end.
Yes.
That was just too radical for the marketplace, and the people weren't quite ready for it. And the sales, Ford sales did have a field day describing this thing in the garage of the GM owners and wondering whether it was a bug or a thing from Mars. And of course the 59 Ford that year again outsold Chevrolet.
Mm-hmm.
But I do remember Jim Wright that year was so concerned. Jim Wright was the vice president of Ford Division, and Charlie Beecham was his direct assistant at that time for the Ford division. And I do remember Jim Wright querying me before the car's introduction about the size of those taillights.
Uh-huh.
He was so concerned that they were just too big. And I kept saying, no, I didn't think so. They were large, I said, but in total, the taillights hung together very well with the sheet metal. Well integrated, it was proportionately okay, and the bumper was all tied with it. And I said, from a professional point of view, as far as design, there's nothing wrong with the aesthetics of the car. But Jim Wright was nervous all the way through until after introduction. And then after introduction, and incidentally, also some dealers made Jim Wright nervous because they had seen pictures of the 1959 Ford back end, and they were concerned that maybe the taillights were this or that, or maybe the car wasn't just right, and Jim Wright became a little bit squeamish and remained squeamish until after the introduction. And of course, after the introduction, all of the dealers were pleased as punch with the car because it was such a great success in sales, and it outsold Chevrolet that year. And the dealers that originally had qualms about it could never be found. You know, they never owned up to their original feelings about the car. And of course, that was the design business. But that year we outsold Chevrolet, and it was one of our banner years, and it was a wonderful comeback after the 58. And we continued, and along after that, what happened at this time, I should take a moment and talk about, was an infectious way of operating in design, in the design office at Ford Motor, that was substantially different from the way General Motors operated, and that always bothered me. And I tried desperately to circumvent this problem and to work around it. The problem, namely, was that the styling office would accommodate all the requests, it seemed, that were made to the design office by management.
Done.
Models, extensive changes to models, and rapid re-showing of models to product planning, management, or additional approval. Now, this meant that many models were started in effort to show management a lot of models, and this shouldn't have been done because many of the models were not to the correct design quality.
You're talking about finished
clays. Finished clays. Mm-hmm. They weren't good quality. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't enough thinking in the development of the models. So it used an awful lot of effort on worthless proposals that should not have been shown because they were not to the proper degree mm-hmm. of quality. And every effort was being made to show a lot of models because they could be ground out in a week or two mm-hmm. or 3 or 4 days mm-hmm. or they could be ground out overnight, or people literally on occasion work 24 hours on a model mm-hmm. in order to get it ready.
Yeah.
And this was wrong.
Whose idea was that?
Well, it wasn't any one person's idea. Mm-hmm. It was a method that had developed slowly mm-hmm. Over the years and finally got out of hand, mm-hmm. where so many models were being proposed and so much effort was being utilized, so much overtime was being used, so much money was being expended, mm-hmm. and so much spinning of the wheels that it became a tremendous handicap. Mm-hmm. Now, technically, what would go wrong would be that some of the steps in developing the model were bypassed. Mm. For instance, the sketching time for themes and discussing was bypassed. The full-size drawings of the proposed themes were bypassed. Models were literally started from the trash bin and with spare parts that were around from various other models.
Right.
So pieces were thrown together and wholesale models assembled and modelers working furiously on and overtime expended, and a tremendous effort was expended, and a tremendous amount of money was used in this effort, mm-hmm. and it was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the General Motors approach, even during this time, at this time in period of the aesthetics, General Motors even then was carefully developing its models through the sketch phase, through the full size, and developing from full size to models, and from the taking the models for the bodies from the body shop and having those models given to the individual studios, very similar to when I was with General Motors. So I was constantly battling in this paper bag, trying to slow down the process, trying to get the designers to exercise their opinions, and trying to get the full-size drawings and so forth started. But I would say that along with this idea of change for change's sake, and the idea of even the 58 that bothered me so terribly, how we changed the 57 to the 58, and which wasn't as successfully designed, was all part and parcel of this overall fever mm-hmm. of a radical request for a lot of models for people to review in order to come to a decision. and it proved taxing to the design office.
Must
finally, it ended and slowed down and got more normal through its own weight. It got out of hand. And finally, it started to get back into the proper methods again. But we did go through that phase at Ford Motor. And it was a very horrendous experience for me because I would spend literally hours at the office and overtime. And being there early in the morning and late at night, plus all my other requirements with the managing the Ford studios.
It seems as if it were a deliberate attempt to stir up a competitive spirit.
It was an attempt to, at the time, by product planning and other people, to make sure that they were really getting the right model, the right design for the next year. And it was the method of selection. And finally, it came to a grinding halt.
It died of its own volition.
And it died of its own way. And as an after effect to this, in the dying moments, the 1960 Thunderbird. This was a unique theme, again, of aircraft derivative with the round taillights built into the bumper. I had talked with George Walker about as a possible Thunderbird theme, and this theme was started as one of the advanced models in Gil Spear's area. And Gil Spear was in charge of one of the advanced areas in one of the studios, and he had a model with these large round Ford-like taillights. And I mentioned to George that would be an excellent proposal or consideration for the Thunderbird to keep in mind, and that it wouldn't be practical for the Ford car because it would be too expensive. Mm-hmm. That bumper system would be just terribly expensive for the Ford car, and nor would it be practical as far as the trunk compartment and the detailing concerned, and the overall height of the car. So the 1960 Thunderbird was this rocket theme that I had proposed to George that we continue with. And also in 1960, there was another proposal that was being considered for the Thunderbird, which was a very formal car. And I remember in the showroom, Mr. Ford asking me point blank, "Joe," he said, "now, what's your reaction to these cars?" Because both cars were really remarkable in their own themes.
Mm-hmm.
And with this car was a little bit at odds with my boss, George Walker. But since Mr. Ford asked me, I had to make a response. And I told Mr. Ford what I had also told George, and I said I felt that the more formal car would make a beautiful Continental. And I said, but the verve and the uniqueness and the sporty quality of this rocket theme is so appropriate as a Thunderbird, and I would recommend that it be considered as a Thunderbird car.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, that's just what happened. That formal car became the formal Lincoln Continental, which was so successful.
Mm-hmm.
And Elwood Engel was very much responsible for this car's development.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I was responsible for the instigating of the development of this 1960 Thunderbird. And again, Bill Boyer was my manager on this car. I believe Damon was still my exec at the time. And now what happened with this car was the Thunderbird, that just prior to introduction, the Ford dealers saw photographs of the 1960 Thunderbird. And some of the Chicago dealers thought, oh my God, we are going to lose our shirts if this car comes out. This is quite different from the previous birds. Mm-hmm. And so about 2 days prior to my long planned trip as a vacation with my wife, Betty, to Europe, mm-hmm. the Thunderbolt hit the Ford studio that we give serious consideration to changing as much as possible within the time limit the 1960 Thunderbird to make it more acceptable or something for the 1960 Thunderbird and the dealers. Well, I didn't know what to do at that time. We were set to go to Europe. The tickets were bought. The hotels had been booked, and Betty knew of my problem, and it was just like a couple days away, and she kept saying, well, Joe, you're such a super manager. You say you've got all this wonderful team and this great bunch of designers. Why don't you, for heaven's sakes, let them do their work and take your vacation? If you don't take it now, you probably won't take it this year. Which I incidentally had lost a few vacation years. Mm-hmm. And so I finally agreed, all right, we'll try it. And we went to Europe. But on the way to the airport, I passed the design office, and I was so tempted just to turn the car in, drive over to my office and say, all right, Betty, please take the car home. I'm not going to Europe. But I finally gave in, and we boarded the plane and went to Europe. But I spent every other day from Europe on the telephone talking with Damon Woods and Bill Boyer in respect to the progress on this car. And what had happened was that this malaise I had previously talked about of the effort of operation of trying to change a car for change sake, and the method of operation of trying to change a car through rapid changes without proper design consideration. Mm-hmm. This all was part and parcel to the tremendous effort to change the 1960 Thunderbird. Mm. And I was aware in Europe that several studios were feverishly changing the fenders, the hoods, radical changes to the car. And finally, of course, I knew what we were doing, and I was trying to stay on top of it from Europe. And of course, I wasn't having a vacation at all. I should have stayed in Dearborn. But when I finally got home, the change was put on a T-Bird, and it appeased management, and they bought the T-Bird then, but also because there wasn't any time left for any changes. We had gone by our change periods,
yes.
You know, for manufacturing and setting
right.
up tools and mm-hmm. engineering and so forth and so on. So we were out of time, luckily, on this car.
Mm-hmm.
And we got by with just two tiny wind splits that were added on top of the 1960 Thunderbird that were there yet not there. They were visible yet not visible. So the change was absolutely a minuscule amount. And this was contributed by a designer in the Thunderbird studio by the name of Bud Kaufman. And this is what I'm referring to as team effort.
Mm-hmm.
Bud Kaufman really saved the day for the 1960 T-Bird, for having come up with the the brainstorm idea that appeased everybody finally of just adding two little tiny wind splits up to it.
Was that the 61 or the, you said
60.
That was the 1960 Thunderbird.
I need double check.
Contribution to the 1961 change effort then to appease management. On, you were right, Dave, it was not the 1960, it was the 1961 Thunderbird, the all-new rocket shape.
You had that in your manuscript.
Yes, and those little welts or wind splits were then taken off on the 1962 Thunderbird.
Describe where they were placed.
They were placed right on a hood from the headlights back to the cowl.
Mm-hmm.
And there were just little ridges about half inch high and about a half inch wide, and they were called wind splits.
It's incredible that this minor, relatively minor change would appease the anxiety.
It appeased, and it was enough to get the T-Bird launched. And it was a very successful T-Bird.
Mm-hmm.
And also Bud Kaufman was responsible for contributing to the development of a special two-seater Thunderbird.
Oh, tell us what.
With the headrests that were built into the deck lid,
mm-hmm.
starting to the deck lid on up into the rear seat. And that was a specialty T-Bird.
Is that called the Sport Convertible?
Sport Convertible.
Right. And these were.
And this was the model.
Yes. Now these were accessories that could be.
They were accessories, and it was as a two-seater really,
mm-hmm.
because the headrests took over the whole rear seat compartment.
And that was Bud Kaufman's contribution.
And
to that,
Bud Kaufman was a good contributor to the concept
mm-hmm, right.
of this theme.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
But we had quite a remarkable group. And I just thought I'd mention the aches and pains that we went through in some of our design effort for developing these cars and appeasing certain people.
At this point, in spite of the triumph over Norbert, or because of your recent triumphs, you're getting some attention from competing firms.
Yes, Ford Motor never knew this, and I never advertised it. Never once did I ever mention it. But I was asked by American Motors, would I consider and would I take over? They wanted me to take over the design departments for American Motors as vice president of design for American Motors. This was prior to the time that Dick Teague took over that responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I evaluated my tenure with Ford Motor, and I evaluated my lifelong love with the Ford cars.
Mm-hmm.
Even as a boy, I was always overtaken with the Ford cars, the Model A's and the T's and all of the models. And all the years I've had with Ford Motor had been very, very satisfying to me as a designer. They were frustrating at times, but generally satisfying. I had a very fine relationship with everybody. I tried to retain a real fine relationship with everybody that came into the studio. I had a nice relationship with vice presidents that were constantly touring our studios and engineers and the manufacturers. Having been in engineering for 4 years during the war, I respected that end of the profession, having worked 4 years in it myself, and I respected the responsibility of the manufacturers, and I respected the know-how of the people that put the cars together, and I just had a nice relationship with people. I remember, though, as my boss, George Walker, would say, you know, you can watch out because you never know who's going to be your boss someday. But even so, I always tried to work with everybody.
And yet, it must have been a very tempting offer because it went beyond automotive design.
It went beyond automotive design. It was an offer that included stock options.
Mm-hmm.
It was an offer that included an increase in salary at the time for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an offer that included a vice presidency of the Ford cars and the white goods.
This was the
Kelvinator end of it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I had several meetings with the American Motors people in a downtown hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, after many painful searchings at home and talking about it with my wife, Betty, I decided that although the salary increase was there, it wasn't really that much more than what I had been earning. And in addition to that, I felt, although the stock options were there, I was very fortunate to have received some myself at Ford that I was exercising and could exercise. And more importantly, I just felt that I had such a feeling of having contributed to the products of Ford Motor over these years that I just couldn't throw that away, and I felt that I still had room to grow at Ford. And I'm glad I stayed, because on the final analysis, it turned out that way. I did have room to grow beyond that point. I did have a salaries increase, and I had more responsibility added to my work, and it just proved to be a continuing nice relationship at Ford. So I have had a wonderful experience at Ford Motor. I feel that I've contributed to the Ford products over the years. I've worked with a bunch of super designers, and I feel that they in turn have had an opportunity to express themselves. And while I was handling the Ford studio, and had a real nice relationship.
Good. If I can take you back to one thread, which I'd like to develop briefly, what was your input and what was your feeling about the Falcon project?
The Falcon project was an enthusiastic car that just lighted everybody in the Ford studio. All of the designers were involved with it. It was a unique challenge because the Falcon was a car that was coming out in competition with General Motors Corvair and the Chrysler small car and our Falcon. They were all to be introduced approximately at the same time.
What was the Chrysler small car at that time?
I don't know its name right offhand right now. Forget its name. But it also was introduced, and it was a car that Exner had a lot of input into, the original Virgil Exner.
Right.
the car was developed, I believe, in the Ford studio with Damon Woods as my exec, and it developed very nicely through the system that I learned back in General Motors of let's talk about it first, let's design and talk about the designs, let's have the input from the designers, and full-size drawings into the model. And it proved correct. and the car was developed and it met its objective in design, met its objective in cost, and it was a tremendous success. At introduction, it was approximately a 500,000 car first year introduction on the Falcon, which also was the goal that the Mustang was set to beat.
May I also ask you one other question? Was Robert McNamara, was that something that he was very enthusiastic about, the Falcon?
Yes, he was very enthusiastic about the Falcon and its concept, and in respect that it was a practical small car, a small family car, mm-hmm. with plenty of room and good fuel economy. And really, in a way, the thinking that went into the Falcon is in good measure much of the thinking that has gone into the smaller cars since the oil embargo.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And it was ahead of its time.
Yes, right.
Really. I would like to talk about the car that was introduced at the time of the Mustang, which was I have to mention concurrently with the 1960 Falcon, the introduction of the 1960 Ford. The 1960 Ford was a unique car from the 1959 in respect that it was sleeker, more aerodynamic by far than the 1959 Ford. And the predecessor to the 1960 Ford was a show car that we had developed in the Ford studio, advanced part of our Ford studio, that was called the Quicksilver.
That was the code name.
And that was the code name. Mm-hmm. That code name was given to this model by George W. Walker. And George Walker was so taken with the car that he showed the Quicksilver model to Mr. Ford, who fell in love with the car. And what we had proposed with the Quicksilver model, the original model, was a low-profile design car with least resistance and good aerodynamics as the next generation Ford.
Uh-huh.
That was an entirely different package from the previous Ford. And this would have required all new engineering from the ground up. Well, Mr. Ford was so taken with the Quicksilver.
This is Henry Ford II.
Henry Ford II. That he wanted to have this car as a 1960 Ford. And so a crash effort was set in motion to develop the 1960 Ford as the derivative model from the Quicksilver. But there was a tremendous problem to overcome. The Quicksilver had a unique package. The cowl was closer to the ground, the overall height of the greenhouse to the ground. The car must have been at least 2 inches lower to the ground. And the cowl was at least 2 inches lower to the ground. And the whole packaging was radically different than the package that we had as a carryover from 1959 to accommodate the aesthetics of the advanced Quicksilver model onto this package. So when we tried to, when the go-ahead signal was given, we remodeled the Quicksilver onto the new package, the old package of the 1959 Ford. And of course, that package was entirely different from the original concept of the Quicksilver, and we had a hard time adjusting the proportions of the new package to the carryover package. And so the 1960 Ford, although it was a recognizable derivative model from the Quicksilver, it never quite had the quality of design in it because of the overall package proportions. They were radically different. So we came into production finally with the 1960 Ford, and it never quite made it as well as the original proposal was. And I remember Jim Wright, who was the vice